Something we'll be considering to a large extent in the coming chapters, including this one, is the concept of cooperation. In cooperation, what we have is more than one entity helping out each other. This can result in an increase in, for example, the functionality or the fitness of the entity that's being helped. It can also result in a decline in the fitness or functionality of the entity that's doing the helping. Generally, we see cooperation evolving within systems in which there's some kind of reproductive linkage between the individuals that in fact are cooperating. In this way, by giving to another, one can potentially enhance one's own reproductive success. And whenever that's the case, there is a reasonable probability that in fact cooperation can be stably maintained within a system. Going even further, we can look at our own bodies. Our own bodies consist of populations of cooperating cells. Most of these cells do not contribute to the next generation. Only the germline in our cells do that. However, by cooperating among themselves, they can increase the likelihood that, in fact, the body as a whole will successfully reproduce, since all of the cells within our body, more or less, possess the same genotype. As a consequence, by increasing the potential for the reproductive cells, the germline, to reproduce, we in fact are increasing, or our individual cells are increasing, their own likelihood that their genotype will be passed on to the next generation. Here in this chapter, we'll be focusing particularly on the evolution of cooperation within populations of microorganisms. In subsequent chapters, we'll be talking about variations on this theme, including in terms of the evolution of symbioses, the evolution of virulence, which has a surprising amount of cooperation involved in it, and also in terms of the evolution of greater size and complexity. Generally, what we have is a cooperative interaction in which there is an increase in fitness, but also potentially the converse, where there is a decrease in fitness, which we would describe as a defection or instead as cheating. So in this chapter, what we'll be considering is in fact cooperation. So as promised, we're going to start talking about economy versus expediency. In shorthand, economy is equivalent to a cooperative behavior or cooperative mode, and expediency is equivalent to a defection behavior or a defection mode. And economy versus expediency really is a physiological concept here. It's a description of, in fact, how organisms use resources and how they translate that use of resources into, for example, population growth. The economical use of limited resources is a case of altruism because of a trade-off between specific growth rate and growth yield. So again, this is growth rate versus growth yield. High growth yield, which is the equivalent to economy, which is equivalent to cooperation. In other words, the economical use of resources increases group fitness. So it's a cooperative behavior. It's the equivalent of avoiding the tragedy in a tragedy of commons. However, this can be attained only at the cost of a decrease in growth rate. So as we've been saying, there's this trade-off between growth rate and growth yield. You can increase your growth rate, but this can have an effect of reducing your growth yield, and you can increase your growth yield, and this can often be achieved at the cost of your growth rate. So by decreasing growth rate, it can have the effect of reducing individual fitness. So economy is good, increases the amount of cooperation that you see. Expediency, bad. It results in the opposite of cooperation. It results in defection. Expediency is a cheating strategy. Expediency is increasing your growth rate at the cost of the efficiency with which you use resources. Economy is increasing your growth yield through more efficient use of resources. So returning back to the phages. So wild type RB69, which we call as the cooperator, under the conditions that were employed in the experiment that we looked at, are more economical. They produce more phage per infection, more progeny phage per infection. So their burst size is higher. The burst size is actually in the range of about 300 phages, new phages per cell. But the RB69 mutant STA5 can have a higher specific growth rate because it's able to infect more bacteria per unit time. What is known as its latent period is shorter. So RB69, shorter latent period, so it has a higher growth rate, excluding burst size, but it does this at the cost of its burst size. The fewer phages you're making per infection, the less economical, the less efficient your use of resources are. RB69 wild type, it produces more phages per infection. It's more efficient in its use of its bacterial resource. It's more economical, but in order to produce more bacteriophage progeny per infection, it takes longer for it to go through its infection cycle. So it at least potentially has a less robust overall population growth rate. So just to remind you of what we're talking about, so the squares are the wild type, the circles are the mutant. What we're seeing here is a standard, what's known as a one-step growth curve. So the RB69 wild type, it takes a few more minutes in order to lyse its host, but it's able to attain a higher burst size as a consequence. The RB69 mutant, STA5, it's able to lyse its cells sooner and therefore have a shorter generation time, but it does so at the expense of its burst size. The burst size of wild type is roughly 300. The burst size of the mutant is about 100. And what we see here in the open symbols is the eclipse period, and this is just showing that the point at which these phages initiate the completion of the first intracellular phage particles is pretty much the same. It's just that very soon after the initiation of those intracellular particles, the initial phage that are made, RB69, the mutant, STA5, lyses, whereas the wild type stays intact for a couple minutes longer and therefore produces more phage progeny. So in the way we've been considering these things, the wild type has a growth yield advantage, it has a larger burst size, whereas the mutant has a growth rate advantage because it has a shorter latent period and therefore a shorter generation time. So the mutant is the cheater and the wild type is the cooperator. Blue is cooperator, red is cheater. Okay, so now the experiment. So that's just the characterization of the phages themselves. The experiment, what I did is I competed the wild type against the mutant. So this is either in individual pure cultures or within the same culture. The open symbols are what you see when the two phage types are growing in separate cultures, so they're not competing against each other in the same culture. And the closed symbols are what you see when the two phage types, in fact, are competing in the same culture. So what I did is I added phages at a certain point in time to a culture that had a certain number of bacteria, and the phages increased in their population numbers. This is actually exponential growth that you're seeing right here. And if you look very closely, you can see that the mutant is actually displaying a slightly faster growth rate than the wild type is. So if you drew a line with the squares, you would see that it is a slightly less steep line than the line you see with the circles. Now, when the two cultures are separate, when the phages are growing in different flasks, what you see is that because there's no competition, the bacteria, the wild type, are able to keep growing and growing and growing until they run out of bacteria, which is what you see up here. And so too, the mutant is able to keep growing and growing until it runs out of bacteria. However, because the wild type has a larger burst size, it is able to produce more progeny overall in what it's grown in its own culture than the mutant is. In addition, because the wild type takes longer to increase its population size, it actually, because it's growing more slowly, it actually takes longer to subdue and infect all of the bacteria in the culture. And this allows the bacteria to grow a bit more as well. And as a consequence, instead of having about a threefold advantage wild type over mutant, you have approximately a tenfold advantage of wild type over mutant in terms of the yield, the total yield of the population. So this is the yield of the wild type, this is the yield of the mutant. Now, this is indicating that the wild type, when grown in pure culture, that is, when growing in a clonal situation where there isn't competition with cheaters, actually does better than the cheaters do. Now, in the situation where you are mixing the two cultures together, so now the STA5 and the wild type are in the same culture, you can see that the STA5 does pretty much the same as it does whether it is in a pure culture or instead in a mixed culture. And this is because, again, the STA5 shows a faster rate of population growth, so it's really dominating this population. It might be doing a little bit worse when it's grown in mixed culture versus pure cultures. You can see the black circles are a little bit below the open circles are. But the wild type is doing much worse. Instead of being up here and having approximately a tenfold higher yield in the end compared to the mutant, when grown in this mixed culture, it has about a tenfold lower yield. So the wild type still has a larger yield per infected bacterium, but it is infecting fewer bacteria. And it's infecting fewer bacteria because the mutant, because of its faster growth rate, is getting to these bacteria sooner. So the mutant is the cheater, and the wild type is the cooperator. And when the wild type is growing separately from the mutant, when the wild type can grow its population in a different location from where the mutant is growing, the wild type does much better than the mutant. The cheating load, however, is seen with this drop in the wild type effectiveness. And this is a consequence of essentially the wild type having to compete with cheaters. Therefore, its strategy of avoiding the tragedy of the commons, or at least partially avoiding it, by showing restraint on its growth. Its strategy of displaying a cooperation or economical growth mode is undermined by the presence of the cheater, which is able to, because the wild type is growing more slowly, take over the population and drive the wild type to lower numbers. So the wild type only does well in its cooperative strategy, in its economical strategy, if it's able to display that strategy without the presence of the cheater. And the cheater is around, the cheater is able to take advantage of the situation and outcompete the wild type, at least within the same culture. So that's the cheater, and that's our wild type cooperator. And then note again, as I've been saying, that wild type wins in pure culture, so the squares are higher in total yield than the circles are when the open squares and the open circles are being compared. That's in pure culture. But the mutant wins in mixed culture. So here, this is the black circles, the filled circles are the mutant growing in mixed culture, and the black squares are the wild type growing in mixed culture. So, an additional consideration beyond economy versus expediency or showing restraint or not restraint is the idea of bottlenecking. And bottlenecking turns out to be really important to the evolution of cooperation. And in fact, turns out to be really important in consideration of the experiment that I just showed you. So, in the absence of an effective method to contain the effects of cheating populations, selection against cheating might occur between populations. Populations founded with few or no cheaters, or those populations founded with genotypes that do not readily evolve cheating genotypes, will have a selective advantage to those suffering from high cheating loads. So if you have two populations that are competing, the population that displays the higher cheating load will not be as effective as the population that displays the lower cheating load. However, this mode of evolution can be limited because it requires that differences between groups rather than between individuals be the primary source of fitness variation. This is Travisano and Volisher. So I actually don't buy that conclusion there. Because if you've got populations that in fact are mostly clonal, and the populations are separate from other competing clonal populations, then in fact you can have these groups where the groups can display different levels of fitness, and therefore one group can be more competitive than another group. So clearly, between infection selection must be important, for example, among pathogens. If you've got a pathogen infecting one organism and a pathogen that is a competitor but infecting a different organism, then overall it will be that pathogen that is able to be transmitted most effectively that will be the more fit pathogen. And if the pathogen can display strategies that require cooperation that allow it to be more effectively transmitted from one host versus a second host, then the one that is displaying the cooperative strategies, the pathogen displaying the cooperative strategies, should display the higher fitness. So here we have two populations, they're separated, and the two populations can display different strategies, one more cooperative, one less cooperative, and the result is that the cooperative strategy can give rise to a group fitness that's higher than that seen in the group that displays the less cooperative strategy. These are actually concepts that we're going to get to two chapters hence when we're talking about virulence. But more than that, when we're looking at the previous experiment, in fact, we saw just these ideas, which we'll get to in a second. So this bottlenecking strategy is exactly what occurs in animals. So animals, considering that we are essentially a group of cells that are hanging out together and cooperating, via sequestration of the germ lines and passage through a single cell stage, the result is that when you have two different animals competing against one another, they're basically multicellular individuals rather than individual cells competing. And those individuals that have been initiated with a single cell, a zygote, so a single cell represents a bottleneck down to a single cell, a zygote that has a cooperative genotype associated with it, that individual is going to be more effective functionally than a organism that has been initiated with a zygote that has a defector genotype associated with it. And the result will be, in fact, that you'll have one group of cells, a multicellular organism, an animal that's more effective than another group of cells, and again, a multicellular organism, an animal. And this represents two different groups that display different levels of cheating within themselves. And the group that displays less cheating, in all likelihood, will display the higher fitness. So that's an exception to this idea of Trevisano and Volisher that the mode of evolution can be limited because it requires differences between groups rather than between individuals. So groups include the groups of cells that make up multicellular animals, and this is actually a concept that we'll return to in three chapters hence when we talk about greater size and complexity. The biofilm example that we talked about, where you have separate microcolonies that are competing against each other, each of those microcolonies represents a group. And the whole idea that Kreft came up with, that essentially selection can occur for these more economical biofilms, these more cooperative biofilm microcolonies. When you have those microcolonies initiated with a single cell, that's exactly what we're talking about here, where you have a single cell, it is represents a bottlenecking, and then every single descendant of that cell will display the same genotype, more or less, with mutation ignored for the moment. And therefore, single cells that display more cooperative genotypes will have the potential to give rise to groups of individuals that are more cooperative than other groups. So when we had those red mushrooms that were increasing, they were bigger, presumably giving rise to more disseminator cells. Those mushrooms consisted entirely of cooperative cells because they were initiated with a single cell. There was a single cell bottleneck prior to the formation of those groups of cells. And the same thing with our animal example. We have a single cell, the zygote, it gives rise to the entire animal. That's a bottlenecking step, passing through that single cell stage. And it means that the cells that make up a multicellular individual are all going to be clonally related to one another. And in fact, they are going to have whatever level of cooperation, the genotype that corresponds whatever the genotype was with that zygote. So if you have a more cooperative genotype giving rise to an animal, it is going to, in fact, be a more potentially more effective, more functional animal, and therefore able to outcompete an animal that's initiated with a defector genotype or a less cooperative genotype. We sort of alluded to this idea. We talked about an entire organism basically consisting of cancer cells. That would not be a good thing. That would be an all D, an all defection strategy. It would be that payoff value of P. And this compares to the all C, or the reward for mutual cooperation, where you have two individuals or a group of individuals that are all cooperating with one another. When you are able to bottleneck to a single individual, it means that all of the resulting individuals in this example are either going to be all cooperation or they're going to be all defection. Groups that consist of essentially more cooperative individuals are going to be potentially more effective, display a greater group fitness, and therefore be able to outcompete the groups that are consist of less cooperative individuals. So bottlenecking also can be invoked to help explain the results seen in the previous experiment. So this bottlenecking, it basically is how you create the pure cultures to begin with that the RB69 wild type or the mutant were grown in. And when you have RB69 wild type growing alone, then it's able to take advantage of its economical growth and give rise to a higher yield. By contrast, if you grow the STA5 mutant alone, it doesn't display the same economy of growth, and the result is a lower overall yield. And how do you make the pure cultures? You make them via bottlenecking. You basically isolate the phages down to a single plaque, which is the equivalent of a colony, and then grow up a new phage stock. So it's essentially a clonally related population that's been generated by bottlenecking. So the previous experiment, competing the RB69 wild type with the STA5 mutant, is possible. The results that you see are possible because of this bottleneck. By contrast, when you have a mixed culture, what you have are a population that has been reduced to, at a minimum, two individuals, one of which is the wild type, the other which is the mutant. And in this case, it's no longer a clonal situation. Instead, you have competing genotypes, and the economy displayed by the wild type is no longer an advantage in these situations, because the expedient individuals, the mutant, are in fact able to outgrow the wild type. So it's only when the wild type has been reduced to just a clonal individual, a population consists entirely of the wild type, does the advantage seen in that experiment with the wild type actually come to fruition. So here is looking again at biofilms, and here we have a microcolony. And the microcolony is initiated with a single cell. And in fact, this is the initiation going this way from 3 down to 1, where you have a single swarmer cell, and the cell adheres to a surface and starts replicating. And that's how you form these microcolonies. So the microcolonies, there's some degree of cooperation that's going on within a microcolony. And the microcolonies are clonal, and therefore their cooperation is a stable, effective strategy, because in fact the microcolony was initiated by a single cell, and that implies that the population was reduced, it was bottlenecked in the course of the initiation of the microcolony. So returning to the RB69 experiment, again, we have RB69 wild type competing with the STA5 mutant. The wild type is the cooperator, the STA5 mutant is the defector. or the cheater. What we have is a potential to think about this experiment in terms of a prisoner's dilemma. Specifically, it's an N player prisoner's dilemma because you have more than two individuals interacting. In fact, you have a whole population of cooperators here, a whole population of defectors here, and then a population of cooperators interacting with the population of defectors. So more than two, so we call it an N player dilemma, prisoner's dilemma. So the situation where you have nothing but cooperators around, we can describe this as mutual cooperation, and therefore the payoff is reward, or R for mutual cooperation. The cooperators, the individuals, the wild type, are only interacting with other cooperators, only interacting with wild type. So they get whatever payoff comes from, in fact, cooperators interacting with cooperators. Now the sucker's payoff is when the cooperator interacts with a defector. And so the sucker's payoff is seen down here with the payoff from associated with the wild type when it's grown in mixed culture. Cooperator is grown in the same culture as defector, and the cooperator loses as a consequence. So you can see that clearly this is the lowest payoff, and here we have the highest payoff in terms of yield, at least. The punishment for mutual defection occurs here, when you have nothing but defectors in an environment. And then the temptation to defect is here, where you have essentially the defector out-competing the wild type substantially when it's grown in the same environment as the wild type. Now, as I said, whether or not this can be described as a prisoner's dilemma is an open question. So, for example, is the T, the temptation to defect, actually larger than the R, the reward for mutual cooperation? It's difficult to say. But nonetheless, we can easily think of these in terms of mutual cooperation, or mutual defection, or where you have a defector growing in the presence of a cooperator, or a cooperator growing in the presence of a defector. But the trouble is that it's not easily turned into what would strictly be a prisoner's dilemma, where, if you'll recall, T is greater than R is greater than P is greater than S. It's perhaps easier to understand this experiment in terms of the tragedy of the commons. So once again, the cooperator is the wild type, the defector or cheater is sta 5. The economical growth is seen with the wild type, the expedient growth is seen with the mutant, and also you have a greater restraint on growth seen with the wild type than you have seen with the mutant. And so the wild type, given that restraint, recall that the mutant displays a steeper growth curve here than the wild type does. The wild type, as a consequence of its restraint, is having less of an impact on its environment, and it's able to gain as a consequence of that by displaying a higher yield than what you see with the mutant. So that's the cheater, and the cheater is an inefficient exploiter of the commons, and as a consequence, it exploits the commons to a greater extent per cheater individual that's produced. And that's the cooperator, and the cooperator is a more efficient exploiter of the commons, and therefore it's able to produce more cooperators per unit of the commons, the resources that are exploited. And so this may be describable as a tragedy of the commons, where the individuals that have less of a tragedy associated with them, that are not exploiting the commons to the same extent, are the more successful individuals, but only when they are grown in an environment where they're not competing with the cheaters. So when you're holding back, when you're displaying restraint, it is only a effective strategy if, in fact, everybody else is displaying restraint. And once you set things up where others, in fact, no longer display restraint, then you end up with the tragedy of the commons. And the tragedy of the commons is, in fact, the difference between these individuals and these individuals here, or alternatively, between these individuals and those individuals there. And just as a caveat, so I mean, both of these phage types are completely obliterating their obliterating their environment. I mean, they're destroying all the cells in the environment. They are maximally exploiting these environments. So it's not as though we're averting a tragedy altogether, but the tragedy is less in the case of the wild type than it is in the case of the cheater. And this is simply because the efficiency with which the exploiter, the cooperator is exploiting the environment is higher, and the rate at which the cooperator is exploiting the environment is lower, and that results in the environment not being destroyed as fast. Therefore, the tragedy being less or occurring later. And this gives the cooperator an advantage, and that advantage is seen in that, in fact, ultimately the cooperator has more cells to infect, and therefore, not only does it have a burst size advantage, but it also has a number of infections advantage. And instead of having an approximately threefold advantage over the cheater, it in fact has about a tenfold advantage over the cheater. So here we have a figure from West et al. Where they're describing a situation that's very similar to that of the RB69 situation that I just talked about. And so what we have here is a individuals that are cooperators that are only interacting with cooperators versus cheaters that are only interacting with cheaters. And you can see, as they've depicted, there's an advantage to the cooperators over the cheaters when, in fact, the cooperators are only interacting with other cooperators. Here, this is being shown as a growth advantage. By contrast, in the RB69 experiment, the same kind of thing was shown in terms of a yield advantage. So the RB69 wild type, the cooperators interacting only with cooperators are shown at the top, the open squares, and the RB69 STA5 mutant, the cheaters interacting only with cheaters, are shown as the open circles here. And it's essentially the same result that the cooperators are displaying some advantage over the cheaters when in fact the cooperators are only interacting with cooperators and the cheaters only with cheaters. By contrast, what we have here is equivalent to the mixed culture experiment. So when the cooperators are in fact interacting with a sufficient number of cheaters, they show a lower fitness overall than in fact the cheaters do when they're interacting with other cooperators. And so what we have here is the equivalent to what we're seeing down here with the RB69 experiment, where this is the cheaters and these are the cooperators in the mixed culture. So this is an equivalent again with mixed culture. It's shown in terms of growth rate, but what we have here are the cheaters able to outcompete the cooperators when the cheaters and the cooperators are growing in the same environment, when we no longer have clonality. So, once again, I mean, the big story here is that the cooperators, the strategy of displaying cooperation, can be particularly useful when the cooperators are only interacting with other cooperators. And with the RB69 example, also, the cooperators were only interacting with other individuals that were clonally related to themselves. And so you have these clonal populations, their behavior is defined by their genotype. Because they're clonal, they only display one genotype, and therefore you can have nothing but cooperators within a population or nothing but cheaters within a population. And if you can bottleneck populations, you can generate a situation where you only have cooperators or only have cheaters. And in these situations, in fact, the cooperators have the potential to outcompete the cheaters. So basically, the highest level of fitness seen in this phage experiment is that where the cooperators are interacting only with cooperators. So the highest level of fitness is achieved given highest percentage of cooperative phenotype. And that's assured via the clonality of this culture. The fact that it's grown in pure culture, it was initiated with a single plaque, the stock that this culture was consists of. And in fact, when you're initiating a plaque, you're initiating it with a single phage. So essentially, this is a group of viruses that are clonally related that have descended from only a single virus particle. And because of that, the fraction of the individuals in this population that display the cooperator phenotype, the cooperator genotype, these number of individuals, a fraction of individuals that display restraint is as high as it can be. And the result is that in terms of yield, this population is the fittest in this that we can see in this experiment. So this is equivalent to what you see in the West et al. Figure, where in fact you have nothing but cooperators replicating alone, and they show the higher growth rate. When you have cheaters that are interacting only with cheaters, they display a lower growth rate. Now, this is an example of the importance of bottlenecking. It's also an example of the importance of cooperators interacting only with cooperators. If you're going to have a selective advantage associated with cooperation, that is sufficient that, in fact, cooperation can evolve over equivalent defection strategies. So we also, looking at the cellular slime mold, we looked at the formation of these fruiting bodies. It's probably a similar story here. The more defectors you have, the less effective the fruiting body. The more cooperators you have making up the fruiting body, the more effective the fruiting body. So there's a general theme that cooperation can be a selectively maintained adaptation to the extent that, in fact, cooperators can isolate themselves away from defectors. The easiest way to do that is by having all of the cooperators related to each other, in fact, related clonally to each other. And the way you can accomplish that is through bottlenecking such that you initiate a population with a single cell, a group with a single cell. And this is explicitly what you see in, for example, animals and plants and also fungi, where you initiate a population of cells that together make up a multicellular individual with a single cell, for example, with a zygote, or in the case of the fungi, with a spore, and also in the case of one of the plant generations with the spore as well. The odd thing about the cellular slime molds is that, in fact, you have these multicellular individuals that are not initiated with a single cell, and that's what makes this particular system so interesting. How is that they can achieve cooperation? How is it that cooperation can be stable, even though they're not initiating a population with a single cell, therefore having that population consist of nothing but either related or clonally related individuals that all are guaranteed, except for a mutation, to display the cooperator phenotype rather than, or cooperator behavior rather than a defection behavior. So this is an exception that with the cellular slime molds, we really don't have a strong sense of how this can be possible unless clonality is somehow assured by means other than simply the bottlenecking. But even with multicellular individuals, even with microcolonies, you still need mechanisms that keep away cheaters from without. And that is achieved via immune systems or the equivalents, as can be seen, for example, in bacteria. And in this way, the clonality of the group is assured, the relatedness of the group is assured, that all of the individuals within the group are cooperating individuals is assured, or at least is much more likely. And the converse to this is that when you initiate a group with a defector phenotype, a defector genotype, you'll have nothing but defector behaviors within that group, and that group, as a consequence, may not be as fit as the groups that, in fact, display nothing but cooperator genotypes. We'll be returning to these ideas when we start talking about the evolution of larger sizes and of greater complexity. Right now, we're going to end this lecture talking instead about the integration of genomes. And so this, to a degree, is returning back to the previous lecture where we talked about the evolution of genomes. And in fact, it is a prelude to the following lecture where we're talking about the integration of different organisms into symbioses, which in fact, in many cases, can result in the integration of genomes as well. The best studied examples of genome integration are those that occur between endosymbionts and their eukaryotic hosts, where, for example, mitochondrial genes are replaced by nuclear transferred versions of themselves. So, in other words, the genes found in the mitochondria migrate to the nucleus, and then the resulting gene products migrate back to the mitochondria. Phage mosaicism is an increasingly well-studied additional example of extensive integration of previously separated genomes. New types of phages can be created when you have relatively unrelated phages infecting the same cell and having recombination events between these phage genomes that just by the chance result in a phage that is functional still. So there's an experiment by Saxon Bull, 2005, it was published in PNAS. It provides a phage-based experimental approach towards forcing genomic integration and therefore genomic cooperation between two phages. And so the experiment looks like this. It was a serial transfer experiment. They're working with filamentous phages, which we'll get to in a second. And they had the system set up so that there were two antibiotics in the growth environment, and each of the phages carried only one of two antibiotic resistance genes. In order for the infections to be successful, which is what we're showing here, you had to have co-infection between the two viruses. Both viruses had to, in fact, be infecting the same cell, producing their different resistance, antibiotic resistance factors, so that the infection could survive. So a selection for co-infection. So it is a co-infection enforcing experimental evolution protocol. So this is just looking at the life cycle of a filamentous phage. And the important thing to note here is that with filamentous phages, they don't lyse their cells. Instead, you have an extrusion of the viral particle across the membranes of the host without actually punching a hole in those membranes. So the host continues to metabolize, the host continues to replicate, and in fact, phages are produced continuously by these infections. So there's an absence of cell killing or lysis. So going back to the experiment, so there is a cooperative retention of the genomes within these two bacteria is the only way that you can get maintenance of the two antibiotic resistance mechanisms. So what we see here, this lighter colored line phage segmented thing displays one or encodes one of the antibiotic resistance genes, and this other thing here, which is the other phage, encodes the other antibiotic resistance gene. It's only when both of them are present within a cell that the cell can successfully produce more viruses. So normally when you have two viruses infecting the same cell, you would expect there to be a competition going on between the two viruses. And in a way, this is a selfish competition because of the way this experiment is set up. Both of these phages need each other. So they can only survive if they're infecting the same cell at the same time. But nonetheless, when they're both infecting the same cell at the same time, there is competition going on for resources within the cell. And this has the potential to reduce the fitness of the cell, the number of viruses that are produced. So you would expect perhaps that these viruses would get better at assuring that in fact they are infecting the same cell, because otherwise both viruses die. And once they are assuring their infection of the same cell, there potentially can be evolution for a reduction in the amount of competition that goes on between the two viruses so that their combined fitness is higher. So that you would expect some kind of evolution of cooperation. And this evolution of cooperation occurs because you are forcing the two viruses to infect the same cell such that their reproductive fates are totally linked to each other. Without the other, one can't. Each of the viruses can't survive without the presence of the others. So, to both reduce competition and increase co-infection, what the two viruses did, what the two phages did, is they essentially turned into one phage. Specifically, what happened is that the two genomes ended up being co-packaged within the same coat, and that increased that assured that the two genomes would find their way into any cell that one of the genomes found its way into, that there would always be co-infection. And then there was further integration of the two viruses such that one of the phages stopped producing its coat proteins, and as a consequence, there was less competition between the two phages during their infection. So the overall yield of the infections in terms of the number of viruses produced was able to increase. And so these ideas are actually shown in this experiment here. So what we have here is time on the bottom. That's the number of passages, the number of times that the phages were exposed to bacteria and then exposed to antibiotics. And what we see over time is that there is a decrease in the packaging of one of the phages within the coat of the other phage. So this is the packaging of the F1 phage into the IKE coat. And then at the same time, there's an increase in the packaging of the IKE phage in the F1 coat. And this increase in the packaging of the IKE phage in the F1 coat is associated with an increase in the co-packaging seen, such that you in fact have both genomes packaged into the same coat, so that you essentially have two phages being turned into one phage, and that assures that when infection by one phage occurs, the genome of the other phage will be present as well. Again, in order for successful infection, you need both of the phages to be present because both of the phages encode genes for antibiotic resistance, and the genes are different genes, and there are two antibiotics, so both of the antibiotic resistant genes need to be present. Therefore, both of the viruses' genomes need to be present during infection for the infection to be successful. The fact that you are getting some packaging of the F1 of the IKE phage into the F1 coat does not imply that you're getting co-packaging, that these are two separate adaptations. One of them is simply the increase in the likelihood of packaging of one of the phages in the coat of another phage, and a second is an increase in likelihood of packaging of both of the phages in the same coat. And then actually a third adaptation that's going on is a decrease in competition that's associated with the loss of the production of the IKE coat. So you're seeing loss of genes that make the coat, thereby reducing the amount of metabolism that's associated with making that coat, those coat proteins, and therefore you have less competition, less interference between the two phages, and then you have a rise in the amount of co-packaging seen. And the co-packaging assures co-infection, the reduction of the number of genes that are present reduces the amount of competition and increases the efficiency of the infection. Both of these represent examples of cooperation where each of the phages is doing something, either sharing its code or reducing the amount of genes it's expressing, that has the effect of increasing the overall fitness, the overall functionality of the overall infection. So to summarize, both phages F1 and IKE initially were autonomous organisms. These are phages that were able to infect individual cells individually and produce phage progeny in the process. And it was only with the imposition of the requirement that the infections be resistant to two different antibiotics, did you end up at the end of the experiment with the genomes of both phages frequently being packaged together in what turned out to be the F1 coats. This doesn't mean that the two genomes were linked together in a physical sense. They were still separate genomes, but they were then found in the same virion. And as a consequence, just a single adsorption with a single phage was able to supply both genomes and therefore both antibiotic resistance genes. And in the process of all of this, with further evolution, the IKE phage genome lost a number of its genes. So at the end, it had retained only three of its genes. So you have these two organisms, they've gotten together, and then evolution occurs such that, in a sense, they're able to become a more effective together organism. And this was accomplished via, at least in part, the loss of various genes by one of the two phages. So the co-packaging ensured a high level of co-transmission between the IKE and F1 genomes, which is necessary because of this need for dual antibiotic resistance. And the minimized IKE genome turned out to be reliant on the F1 phage genes for its packaging. So therefore, what IKE lost was its coproteins and morphogenic processes. So the IKE genes lost presumably were those that duplicated F1 functions, F1 genes. And this suggests that there was a streamlining of the initial solution of co-packaging, which in turn was adopted as a means of resolving the initial problem of the need for dual antibiotic resistance. So there was an initial problem, basically, that was one of lack of linkage between two essential genes, and these two essential genes were the antibiotic resistance genes. Now, the essentiality of these genes was imposed upon the two phages by the experimenters, by the experimental conditions, but they are nevertheless under the conditions of the experiment that was run, the two genes were essential to the reproduction of the two phages. So then linkage between these two genes were necessary for the survival of both phages, and so that selected for a linkage, and this linkage was achieved via co-packaging of the two genes into the same genome, and the easiest way to achieve this co-packaging was for there to be a co-packaging between the genomes of the two phages. So rather than just picking an individual gene and moving it into another phage's genome, the two genomes simply merged. They didn't merge completely, but they became co-packaged and therefore linked. This was followed by a streamlining, which at a minimum involved a reduction in the redundancy between the two genomes. And this either was or could have been followed by further coevolution that further reduced conflicts between the two genomes, so that essentially once these two phages had to replicate together, their replication became as effective as it could be. And one way of increasing the effectiveness of this replication is by reducing conflicts between the two genomes. The genes that are associated with the two genomes, and this reduction in conflict is one aspect of what can be described as coevolution between the two organisms, or alternatively, between the genes of the two organisms. So the co-packaging is equivalent to this co-vertical transmission or linkage between the two organisms, or between the genes associated with the two organisms. In fact, the linkage is in a traditional sense of the word linkage, where you have two genes that are difficult to separate via recombination. And they became difficult to separate because they were placed into the same coat, the same virion, rather than necessarily being placed directly adjacent to each other and becoming physically linked to one another. That presumably could happen over the longer term if the experiment had been continued for many, many generations. But nevertheless, you have a linkage in the sense that recombination is no longer able to separate the two genes. The two genes are no longer being packaged into separate virions, and therefore separatable. They're no longer separatable, and therefore they're linked together. Co-vertical transmission tends to select for cooperation because the gene fates become intertwined. So we can think of this in terms of the two organisms. Now they are both, they have their fates intertwined. They're both being packaged into the same virion. But you can also think of it as the genes associated with the two organisms now having their fates intertwined and being packaged into the same virion. And then lastly, linked genes, they can't have too many interests that diverge from one another. If they do, then there's conflict, and this is going to reduce the fitness of both organisms. If both organisms are dependent upon each other, they have to smooth off the rough edges. They have to set things up so that they're not interfering with each other's replication. Because if you're dependent upon the replication of another, you want to make sure the other has life as easy as possible to, therefore, is able to display or undergo that replication. If you're dependent upon another person, you want to go out of your way to make sure that other person is as successful as possible in such a way that they're able to do whatever it is that you need to do, you need them to do for you. Now we're going to continue onward and talk about when two different organisms become intimately intertwined in symbioses or endosymbioses. And the endosymbiosis example is an extreme where you have two organisms, their fates become intimately linked. They are no longer able to live separately from one another. And you see this co-packaging. I mean, essentially, in the case of endosymbionts, one cell is found inside of the other cell and replicates in association with the other cell. And you also have a streamlining where redundancy between the two organisms is reduced. And you also have a smoothing off of the rough edges, the conflicts that can occur between the two organisms, because you can't have these conflicts and have two organisms successfully reproduce with a very high effectiveness if in fact they're undermining each other's abilities. And so you have a tendency to lose those genes that don't contribute to the functionality of the now dual organism. And in fact, you also particularly lose those genes if the organism can get away with it that actually serve to actively interfere with the dual functionality of the now dual organism.